Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to the library and today's event with Brad Evans. First, we thank Elliott Bay Book Company for co-presenting today's event. We thank the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our authors series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Here's Karen Maeda-Allman from Elliott Bay to introduce the rest of the program.
Good afternoon. I'm Karen Maeda-Allman from Elliott Bay Book Company, and it's our pleasure to co-present this event with Seattle Public Library and the University of Washington Press. Of course, you're all here to hear about the book Return to the Land of the Headhunters, Edward S. Curtis, The Kwawakawuk, and The Making of Modern Cinema. This book was edited by Brad Evans, who's here today, and also by Aaron Glass, and published by University of Washington Press. This book, much like the 1914 silent film that inspired it, is the product of many, many years and many different types of scholarship and of the ongoing collaboration of artists, film scholars, historians, and critics, both indigenous and non-indigenous, a collaboration that began even as the film was being produced. It's a fascinating portrait of what was essentially a joint project between photographer Edward S. Curtis, who also wrote the script, and the Kwawakawuk, who acted, provided source material, and consulted on the film, as well as it's the story of the rediscovery and painstaking reconstruction of the film, its score, its context, and the reconstruction of its meanings, reception, and history, now seen within a contemporary context. Once forgotten by all but a few, notably Bill Holm, who also plays an important role in the story, and by the Kwawakawuk themselves, Return to the Land of the Headhunters, the film, is now regarded increasingly as a landmark in film history, as well as an important document pertaining to both our cultural and national histories. We look forward to screenings, more screenings of the restored film in the fall. Has anybody seen the film? So some of you have, yes, okay. So there will be more screenings, we hear. In the meantime, we're pleased to co-present this program, which includes a discussion of some aspects of the book and some clips. So we're welcoming the book's editor, Brad Evans, Associate Professor of English at Rutgers University. He's a specialist in 19th and 20th century American literature, including African American and Native American literature, as well as a critic and a historian of anthropology and folklore. He is also the author of one of the chapters, which won't be a surprise. So please join me in welcoming Brad Evans.
So I'd really like to just thank the Seattle Public Library and Elliott's Bookstore for hosting this event, and Natasha Varner, who I saw walk in for the UW Press, for helping arrange it. Thank you, Natasha. In absentia, I'd just like to introduce my co-editor quickly, Aaron Glass, who's an anthropologist at Bard. So our collaboration is an English professor and anthropologist working on this project for the last 10 years. And I'd also like to acknowledge our friend Andrea Sanborn, who passed away 2 years ago. She was the former director of the UMISTA Cultural Center at Alert Bay out on Vancouver Island. And this project really could not have happened without her dedication to Kwakwaka'wakw culture and her tireless work for its preservation. So I just want to get a lot of you raised your hand saying you had already seen the show or the movie. So just it would help me to know how to pitch this. How many of you have seen the War Canoes version? So this was the 1973 version. Okay. And did any of you see the Headhunters version, which was here in Seattle in 2008, was the only other time it was screened? So a few of you have seen Headhunters. Okay, good. That helps. will go along as if no one has really seen either of them. Aaron Glass and I have been on this restoration project for the last 10 years. And during the process of our work on the film, we've had two goals in mind. The first was to make the point that in The Land of the Headhunters, the film that we'll be seeing some clips from, is not a documentary. It's not a documentary film. Rather, it's a silent feature film. And one of the goals of the project was to resituate the film within the context of 1914 silent feature films and the emergent movie industry in the United States. The second goal was to put the film into dialogue with contemporary Kwakwaka'wakw communities and also with scholarly communities and other indigenous people in order to better understand the film as a historical and intercultural artifact with lasting resonance and effect. So in this talk, what I'd like to do is walk through these two goals that we had, resituating it within film history, keeping it in contact with contemporary Kwakwaka'wakw communities. And I'll be showing you four or five clips from the film and some other materials, some background material. People might want to silence their phones if you have a chance. So, first point. In the Land of the Headhunters is a melodramatic, silent feature film, an epic of love and war set before Europeans arrived on the North Pacific coast, which is to say set sometime, say, around 1770, sometime before 1770. It was directed and produced in 1914 by the legendary photographer Edward S. Curtis, who, as I'm sure you all know, made Seattle his home for a while. This was the first feature-length film with an all-Native American cast. It starred non-professional actors from the Kwakwaka'wakw communities in British Columbia, people who were already known at the time for their spectacular visual arts and dances, as well as their resistance to assimilation. The other interesting thing about the movie, historically, is that it was originally accompanied by an orchestral score composed for the film by John Bram, a man who is best known to the extent that he's known at all for his work with Gilbert and Sullivan in New York at the turn of the century. As you see on this billboard, which imagine this at 8 by 20 feet and plastered on the side of a building here in Seattle advertising the film, it was advertised as being Native music symphonized, a little bit as if Bram was channeling Dvorak or Bartok and using folk music as inspiration for an orchestral score. The interest is with the musical score is that this is the earliest surviving musical score for a silent picture, a silent feature-length film. So this gives the film an added boost in its film historical impact. I thought we'd start just by giving you a really quick taste of the film with a clip. This is a clip that I have to say, and as I'll explain, it's a clip that got me excited about working on the movie when I started 10 years ago because of the melodrama of the inner titles. We'll see it. The movie, just to set this up, has three hopefully we don't need to evacuate. Sounds like we're good. Are we good? Yeah, okay, great. So there are three interwoven stories, and you get a little taste of it here. The first is it's a Romeo and Juliet love story. So it's a story of forbidden love between the hero, Modana, who you see lying here, his lover, Naida, a high-ranking princess. And the problem is that Naida has been promised to an evil sorcerer as a bride, and a lot of the movie revolves around Modana waging war on the evil sorcerer in order to win his bride. So that's the first story. The second story that's interwoven is, so you have a love story, then the story of headhunting, from which the title. This is a very sensationalized version of Kwakwaka'wakw culture in, again, sometime, say, 1770, early 1800s. And so a lot of the film is in kind of epic Indian warfare battles with lots of fake heads being shaken around. The third level of this is somewhat ethnographic. There are a lot of Kwakwaka'wakw dances and ceremonials being performed in the masks and the costumes that we all know, either from visiting the folks up in Alert Bay or from the natural history museums where they're on display around the country and around the world. So we'll start with this little clip where we're introduced to Modana, who is holding a vigil, and he'll meet up with his lover, Naida, and you'll see the evil sorcerer spying on him. Sorry, I know everybody starts seeing it and you want to keep going. So a critical success, but a financial failure. The movie was very shortly lost after its release in 1914. And so part of what I want to talk about is what happened to the film after that time, which we now know quite a bit about. I think to start this story, the first thing to realize is that there are different versions of this film. This project took shape after Aaron and I met a decade ago, and we had each been working on different aspects of the film, which stressed its significance as a part of the motion picture industry, as part of an entertainment. So we were looking at parts of the film that were stressing the fictional aspects. But to understand our interest in the fiction of the film, you have to realize that in 1973, another version of the film had been released. The title had been changed. And it was called In the Land of the War Canoes. In the Land of the War Canoes was produced by Bill Holm and George Quimby, who in the early 60s had found the film in the basement of the Field Museum in Chicago and had restored it with the idea of taking it back to the Kwakwaka'wakw community. Bill Holm is famous as a Northwest Coast art historian and artist. He had worked with the community for quite some time and had been told by his friends that they had this memory of having made a movie with Edward Curtis back when they were young and when their parents were young, and had suggested that he go looking for it. So if you were at the Burke Museum on Thursday, Bill Holm was there, and he told the story about meeting up with George Quimby in the basement of the Field Museum and coming across this film. They had at that point a very fragmented version of the film. The film in 1914 was shot on nitrate, 35 millimeter nitrate, which is highly flammable and toxic when it catches on fire. And the copy in the Field Museum had caught on fire a couple of times. It was fragmented, it was in pieces. By that time it had been switched to 16 millimeter safety stock. And so they were working with pieces, really. But they put it together as well as they could. They tried to desensationalize it by changing the title from In the Land of the Headhunters to In the Land of the War Canoes. They changed the intertitles, making them more ethnographically explanatory. And the biggest thing that they did was they added a soundtrack in the Kwakwala language by descendants of the original cast who watched the film with Bill and George and recorded dialogue that they thought would be appropriate to the scenes that were being shown. So I want to show just one clip of the War Canoes version so you can get a taste of what we've been doing in the restoration. Whereas Bill and Holm and George Quimby were interested in getting a document to show the authenticity and the survival of Kwakwaka'wakw culture, we've been interested in taking it back to 1914. So you get a sense of that here. Was the sound too loud on that last clip? Yeah. Let me, I'll try to adjust this one so it's not so.
Oh,
and I are fairly convinced that this version is actually going to remain the preferred version for many people. And our new work on restoring the film to 1914 isn't necessarily meant to replace this version. I think that this was an important work in 1973 in particular because it was a moment when anthropology was reassessing itself as a field and was becoming very self-conscious of the coincidence of anthropological work and colonial expansion during the time. And so for 1973, this was one of the first works of what, as a history of anthropology, I would call a piece of experimental anthropology or experimental ethnographic filmmaking. It was really trying to take the film back to the Kwakwaka'wakw and give them a voice in it. Aaron and I have taken a slightly different approach to it. With this 1973 version in hand, we wanted to go back to 1914 and ask a slightly different question. What difference would it make in our understanding of the film and of Kwakwaka'wakw history to stress the fact that this was a fiction film, that it was not intended, at least by Curtis, to be a documentary at all, but a silent feature film and one of the earliest pieces of a feature-length film with a score, color-tinted and toned, to emerge in the early 19-teens. The film was certainly a precursor to documentaries, and we know, for example, that Robert Flaherty saw the film because Edward Curtis screened it for him in New York. So Robert Flaherty made Nanook of the North, what generally considered to be the first documentary. So we know that it's important in the history of documentary, but it seemed like there was another history to tell about it and other questions to be asking about what the Kwakwaka'wakw who participated in the film, in the making of the film, thought they might be doing. So just, I won't play the full one, but just to give you a sense of how different the two are, I'll play this short clip, which is the exact same scene that you just saw of War Canoes, but in the new 2014 version. So. So there's a really different emphasis, as I think you get. In the first one, we get a performance of the Glaxamila dance as it's performed largely in the Big House still today. In the other, we get a celebration, which in the film, this actually comes after the destruction of Modana's family house. So this is the evil sorcerer's family celebrating the destruction of their enemy. So we get very different kinds of movies. So just to stress the different things that you see in the 1914 version, is the color tinting and toning. So one thing that we don't often think about with old films is that they were color tinted and toned. When we think of old films in black and white now, the reason they're in black and white is that they've been transferred to black and white safety stock at some point because of the problem with the decomposing, flammable, toxic nitrate that they were originally put on. For this project, we found a reel, about 10 minutes of film in the UCLA Film and TV Archive of the original nitrate, the 35 millimeter nitrate. And from that, the folks who did the reconstruction of the film at UCLA were able to determine the color tinting and toning scheme that Curtis had used. This was a post-production way of coloring film that involved dipping it into color tints and then using acid to take out the tones to give it different colors. It was very sophisticated color tinting and toning, which speaks to the ambitions of Curtis as a filmmaker. He had the same ambitions, I think, for everything he undertook, both for photography and for film. So we get the color tinting and toning restored throughout the entire 1914 version. There's the famous work in it. We have a lot of the missing footage, so an extra 10 minutes of film, which I'll show you a clip from that at the very end. It's really quite beautiful because it's the original nitrate with no real deterioration. We also use Library of Congress still images. So still images that Curtis gave to the Library of Congress for copyright reasons. And we use those to fill in missing parts of the story. We had found the original musical score, so the John Bram score, at the Getty Research Institute. So we're in the unusual situation of having more music than we had film. We had the entire score, but the film had, you know, at various times burned up or been lost or destroyed. So one of the things that we tried to do in the restoration was to fill out the movie in order to match it up to the score. And because the score was so important, this seemed to make sense. The film was restored by the UCLA Film and TV Archive. They said this is the first time that they've ever restored an early movie where the restoration was driven by the musical score and not the other way around. So I want to show one more clip here, which is a very dramatic scene where it comes in the middle of the movie. Towards the end of the first part of the movie, and Yaklus, who is the brother of the evil sorcerer who has been killed by this point in the film, comes and destroys Modana, the hero's village, and kills Modana's father. It's a very dramatic section, and it's interesting what they did with the reconstruction of the film, because they had some pieces of this from the 35-millimeter nitrate. This isn't the long section they found at UCLA, but a small section. And you could see the film through the decomposition. So what they decided to do was actually use the decomposition in the film. So you'll see in this clip regular film, decomposing film, which you can kind of see through, and then Library of Congress stills for a very dramatic episode, the burning of the village. So we'll play this one for you. I think that I've got to say the first time I saw this, after having worked so long on the documentary version, the War Canoes version, and we saw this when it screened in 2008 here at the Moore and at the Getty Center in California and up in Vancouver, all of a sudden you just realize that this was really a dramatic movie, that the love and war and the death scenes were really dramatic in a way that we never really knew before. The question, with all of this in mind, becomes what then happened to the film after 1914? And what can we say about Kwok 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 involvement in 1914 with the movie? So I thought I'd walk us through a little bit of the history of what happened to the movie after its initial screening. So we know that the film premiered here at the Moore Theater in Seattle at the same time that it premiered in New York at the Casino Theater. For a long time, we didn't know much more than that about what had happened to the film after its release. But we know a little bit more now by tracing newspaper archives and other materials, where we've been able to track the film so that we know that it was shown at least, in at least a half dozen cities. And I think that it'd be fair to say that it probably had a small run in two dozen cities, perhaps. It was distributed by the World Film Company, which you see their logo up at the top with the elephant. The World Film Company at that time was known for trying to bring in a high class of movie. So by 1914, the movies had been in existence for quite some time, and the Indian Western genre was considered by many to be already used up. Right, this was an old, hackneyed genre. By 1910, there were even Native American delegations. There was a Sioux delegation that went from California to Washington, D.C. to complain in 1910 about the stereotypical representation of Native Americans by the cinema. So one can assume that what Curtis was doing was trying to give you something more than just the hackneyed Western version of the film. One of the things that we suppose that he was doing was trying to develop a new genre, the Northern. So we had the Westerns. Curtis seemingly was trying to give you a Northern. Here is a poster for the original movie that advertises it as an epic drama of the Northern Sea. So doing for the Arctic what other cinema people had already done for the West. The other thing that it seemed to be promoted as was as an epic and a spectacle. Here, a mighty spectacle drama of exotic thrills. And spectacle becomes a key word in this story because it was a word used to describe films like D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation and a three-hour-long Italian art film which had premiered in Seattle 6 months before the screening of Headhunters called Cabiria. So it was kind of trying to be a spectacle film, which was an art film that combined a big story with beautiful landscape photography, large sets, exotic places. So a lot of the restored film, you can see just beautiful shots of the water, seagulls, sea lions, combined with this kind of epic story. These are just some more. This was at the Carnegie Hall where it played. This wasn't where it premiered, but a Carnegie Hall screening. This is from the Carnegie Hall Playbill. And one more poster. So after this initial run, this initial set of screenings, we lose track of the film for a while. It disappears. We know that in 1922, Curtis sold his copy of the print to the American Museum of Natural History, where it was lost or destroyed, probably destroyed. Most of the film from this period was destroyed because it was a fire hazard. By a stroke of luck, a copy of the film ended up in the Field Museum, donated by this man, Hugo Zeider, who was an eccentric collector, a real Citizen Kane-like figure. He loved old movies, he loved anything having to do with Indians, and he liked circus paraphernalia. He was in Danville, Illinois. I spoke to him shortly before he passed away. He had three garages on his property filled from floor to ceiling with old movies. He had acquired this, he thought, probably sometime in the 30s, from a friend of his who collected old movies out of dumpsters outside movie houses in Chicago and sent it to him. in 1945, he gave his copy to the Field Museum. The kind of interesting story, the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, and the interesting story about that one is he gave it to them with no clue that it had anything to do with Edward Curtis. He gave it to them with a letter saying, this looks like something I had seen in the National Geographic, and I thought it might interest you. And the curators at the Field didn't recognize it as Curtis either. They saw it as documentary evidence of Kwok life, you know, sometime around the turn of the century, maybe. So Curtis, who is also often known and criticized for promoting the idea of the vanishing race, is himself the one who vanishes from the history of the film. So I always like to say it's a story about the vanishing Curtis. This leads me to the second goal of the project, which is to say just a few things about what we might speculate the Kwok thought that they were doing by participating in Curtis's movie. One thing that I think we can be sure of is that they were not documenting Native life in 1914. The historical setting before the arrival of white men in which the movie is produced would have been sometime in 1770. We're filming this in 1914, a moment of great political political distress in the Kwok community. By 1914, the Kwok knew the political and cultural realities of colonial modernity. They were familiar with sometimes wanted and often unwanted attention of anthropologists, tourists, missionaries, government agents, artists. From 1884 to 1951, an amendment to the Canadian Indian Act, known as the Potlatch Prohibition, meant that the Kwok communities were not officially permitted to do many of the things that take center stage in the more ethnographic parts of the movie, the parts featuring the dances and the magnificent regalia. So they were able to perform for Curtis's camera things that they were not, at least legally, able to perform for themselves. The political prohibition, the Potlatch Prohibition, was a blatant attempt by the colonial government to force the assimilation of indigenous peoples. And, of course, it was flaunted both privately and on occasion quite publicly by the Kwok at the time. This is a picture of Kwok chiefs in regalia welcoming a colonial agent. So even in 1914, they were using dance as a kind of political tool to promote their own culture and situation. Here's another group dancing for Prince Arthur in Alert Bay in 1912. The Potlatch Prohibition was going on, but the Kwok had a long history of participating in very public performances of their own culture. They had been to the World's Fairs, first with Franz Boas for the Columbian World's Exposition in 1893, and they knew the movies, so they had been to the movies. This is a letter from George Hunt to Franz Boas mentioning the couple of times that he had been to the movies. The letter is kind of interesting. It's written one line in Kwakwala and one line in English, and presumably George Hunt is kind of teaching Boas how to read Kwakwala. And so he's doing a literal translation. So I wrote the English on the left, which sounds a little bit like gibberish, but it's because it's a literal translation from the Kwakwala, mentioning having been to the movies. The other thing that we know is that by the time that they were making this movie, there was a long history of Native Americans performing in the movies. And this is a really short clip, which I'll play, and I can talk over this one because it's silent. This is from the Edison Cinemas in 1894, one of the very first Edison experiments with motion pictures, in which he was recording this performance by folks who were involved in the Buffalo Bill show. So the Kwakwala knew the movies, they knew melodrama, they knew performance. So we can come back to the film and ask what it was that they might think that they had been doing in 1914 when they agreed to participate with Curtis. It would probably take a book, and this is my chance to plug the book, it would take a book to say what it was that they thought they were actually up to. But one thing that we could say that they were doing is having a good time. This is a picture of the filming, from the filming of the movie, where you see some of the actors sort of clowning around in the back. They were involved in making costumes for the movie. They made sets for the movie. They made wigs for the movie. All of the long hair, these are all wigs. They made sets. So you can kind of see around the edge of this, this was a false front that they put on the buildings in order to produce the set for the film. More seriously, though, the argument that we would make is that they adopted traditional ceremonies for Curtis's ambitious fictional feature film, and they did so while refusing to play the vanishing race. Thus, the Kwakwaka'wakw retained embodied cultural knowledge despite the Canadian prohibition of the potlatch, and at the same time, they made a vital contribution to the development of modern art and modern cinema. What we get with The Restored in the Land of the Headhunters, ultimately, is a much more complicated and interesting account of intercultural encounter taking new forms and branching out in many different directions over the last 100 years, both toward the history of the movies and its negotiation in the new sensorium of modernity, but also toward the history of indigenous cultural survival under the strains of early 20th century colonialism. That we're still fascinated by this film, that it attracts such a large audience at events like this and such a broad range of scholarly interest and a broad range of interest among the Kwakwaka'wakw themselves, is a testament, I think, to the century-long cultural encounter, not only between Curtis and the Kwakwaka'wakw in 1914, but between them and the many audiences who have taken an interest in the film since then. So I'll leave you with the last clip. This is my favorite clip from the new film because it's really a beautiful section that is from the original 35mm nitrate. You can get a sense of exactly what Curtis was planning with the color tinting and toning. You also get an amazing dance by the heroine, Naida. So it's a really beautiful little clip of film, and we'll end with that. I should say, this is when Naida is dancing for her life. She's been captured by the evil sorcerer who is either going to kill her or take her the story. She does escape. Modana comes and rescues her. The story ends with a canoe chase, and then they have the beautiful canoes stealing along the coast, and Modana and his group lead them into a very dangerous strait, and the evil sorcerer's brother, Yaklus, his canoe dumps over, and they all die. And so it's a happy ending. So that's the end of my talk. I'd be very happy to answer questions. Yeah?
Have you found the exact locations where the film was made inside?
Yeah, so that's right. So the question is, do we know where the film was made? And yeah, we know exactly where the film was made. So if you're familiar with Vancouver Island, the main reserve for the Kwakwaka'wakw is at Alert Bay. Most of the film was up further north than that, near Fort Rupert, way up towards the tip. And let's see, did we see it in this clip? There's one section, Deer Island, which is a smaller island off of the coast of Fort Rupert, is where a lot of it was filmed. Yeah, so it's very clear now. Which leads to an interesting point, actually. We've shown this film to our Kwakwaka'wakw friends, many of whom are descendants of the audience. Are there any Kwakwaka'wakw people in the audience today? No. Okay. We screened the film last Thursday out at the University of Washington, and a friend, Andy Everson, was there, whose grandma was Naida, the heroine. So we know where it was filmed, and when we take it back, that's why I say that the War Canoes version might be the preferred version, because for contemporary Kwakwaka'wakw peoples, this is pictures of their grandparents as movie stars, right? And when it was remade in the 70s, it was Kwak 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 people doing the dialogue. So they hear the language and also see relatives, really. So, yeah. So we can know quite a bit about where it was filmed. Yes?
Who owns the rights to the two different versions? What is the possibility that they might use initial screening
of the public? Right. So the rights are currently owned by Milestone Film, which has the film going through the festival circuit right now. We will definitely be in Seattle at some time, though the date is uncertain. It'll probably be December or January, and then it will be available as a DVD and Blu-ray shortly after that, so probably December, January. And both of the pieces will be on it, so they'll have both the 1914 Headhunters version and the 1973 version. So you'll be able to look through both of them, yeah. I guess the other way to answer that is to say that parts of the film are at UCLA, so they have parts of the rights. Parts of the film is the Field Museum. Parts of the rights are the University of Washington. The Getty has a hand in it because of the music. So it's been a big institutional effort to bring it all back together. Yeah. Yes?
Do we know anything about how performers were compensated?
They were paid. They were paid. I don't know how much they were paid. I don't know what the going rate would have been. But Buffalo Bills, Native American performers were getting about $5 a day, two to $5 a day, which might have been the going rate. But they were all paid. Yep. Yes?
What's the status of the Kwak 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 tribe today?
So the status of the Kwak 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 tribe today, bigger than it has ever been. So the Potlatch Prohibition finished in the early 70s, really. It officially ended in the 50s. But in the 70s, there was a major repatriation effort for a lot of the materials. So the Umista Cultural Center, which is one of our institutional partners, and I introduced Andrea Sanborn and gave thanks to her at the beginning, who's Kwak 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 and worked at the Umista, they received repatriated masks and regalia in the early 70s. Which is when their museum formed. There's been a major revival of traditional life among Native Americans and First Nations across the country, and the Kwak 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 are very much part of that. When we screened the film in 2008, the really magnificent thing about it, that screening, was we would screen the film and have a performance by a professional dance group, the Gwawina Dancers, many of whom are descendants of the original cast members, who both explained the dances that were shown in the film and then performed some of them. It's really quite magical. So the question is, how did the Kwak 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 receive the musical score? Mixed. You know, I really do think that for many of them, the Kwakwala language score is going to be the preferred version. I think Andy, who saw it the other day, likes it. It is what it is. It's a Hollywood Indian-ish kind of score. It's well received to the extent that you want to see it as a fictional film. But it's not authentic, and these dances are, the dances that are shown in the film are regulated by very strict protocols within the First Nations. These are privileged dances that are passed from one family to the next. And the one scene that we saw, the ethnographic piece, which we just referred to as the curtain drop scene, is a very high privilege dance. Only a few people have the privilege to do it, and it's usually done at the beginning of a potlatch or other performance to signal all of the different dances that you'll be seeing over the course of it. So the idea of putting that with this kind of Hollywoodish score, to them is, you know, it is what it is. It's Curtis, their family members agreed to be in the movie, and this is what you end up with, but I think they prefer the other. There was a question way up at the top. But yes, go ahead.
You said you've been working on this for about 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Did your interest in Curtis come out of the interest in this film, or was it vice versa?
It came out, my interest in Curtis was from this film, I've got to say. I wrote a book, the first book I wrote is called Before Cultures, and it's a prehistory of cultural pluralism that asks the question, so a little story about the word culture.
It was singular in the English language until around 1900. If you go and look for cultures in the plural in the way that we use it today to talk about Kwakwaka'wakw culture or Seattle football culture or East Coast culture, when we talk about cultures, that word did not exist in English before about 1900. So the book that I wrote was, how is it that in the 19th century people described cultural difference without recourse to that word? For us, I think it's really hard to say Kwakwaka'wakw culture. And how do you describe difference without recourse to that word? I was interested at that time in anything that was anthropology and art. I'm a literary scholar. I was interested in the way that Mark Twain's travel down the Mississippi, or Huck Finn's travel down the Mississippi, stops and sees local cultures. And so anything that seemed to combine that anthropology and art interested me. And so I came across Curtis. I came across In the Land of the War Canoes. I knew his portfolios, I knew the pictures and the books, but I was interested in this movie because War Canoes looked like a documentary, but having done some reading, I knew that it was supposed to be a melodrama. And so my initial interest was to try to find the melodrama part of it. It was the, that I can go walking hand in hand down the misty paths of copper. You know, I saw that and I was like, this is what I wanted to see. So, do you have one more question or? Yeah. The film is now 70 minutes, so it was the silent feature films at that time went anywhere from an hour to 3 hours. This was a 6 to 7 reel film. Each reel was about 10 minutes long. So it's now at about 70 minutes. And we think we've got most of it. Do we have time for one more? Yeah. Right, so the question is, were they able to use the film in order to recover some of the dances? And yes, yeah. When we had the Gwawina dancers in 2008, there's a person named William Wasden, who's a very high-ranking Kwakwaka'wakw, who is just a store of cultural knowledge. And when we watch the film with him, he'll look at it and say, oh, you know, he's a good dancer. You know, he's got these good moves. And actually use the film at times to reconstruct their own cultural past to a certain extent. I mean, it is a very tricky story because in the 50s and 60s, it was a bit of a low point for Native American culture with the Kwakwaka'wakw. You know, the potlatch prohibition had worked. And so the kind of renaissance of Kwakwaka'wakw interest and traditionalism has very much changed. It's different than it was in 1914 even. So there's a lot of interest now in developing and maintaining these kind of cultural traditions. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.